I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, hello, and welcome, or should I say welcome back, to the Indie Football Podcast. This is the World Cup special preview edition. I am Ed Mallion, sports editor of The Independent, and alongside me today, just one person in the studio, but it is our chief football writer, Miguel Delaney. Hello, Miguel.
Hello.
We do have Jack Pitt-Brook dialing in on the phone. He is already on his way to Rapino, England's base for the World Cup. That's about, was it an hour north of St. Petersburg, where he'll be based for most of the tournament. Johnny Liu is having a few days off before he heads off to, and he's going to be based in St. Petersburg. Mm-hmm. You and I will be based in Moscow. You're going to be doing a lot of traveling around, yeah, based from there.
Yeah.
I'm going to kind of stay put and run things in Moscow. Critch is going to be our kind of spare man to go off and, you know, when stuff kicks off, get, yep, in the mixer, get his nose in the dirt.
A lot, maybe it kind of shows maybe some of the logistics of the World Cup. It's probably the most vast country the World Cup's been ever held in, and yet to get between places, no matter where you are, you pretty much have to come back to Moscow. I think in the first weekend of the tournament, I'm in Sochi for Spain-Portugal, and Rostov is really close on the map, so it looks like it's an hour drive. It's actually 8 hours on a train. But to get from Sochi to Rostov, I have to go back up to Moscow and get a connecting flight back.
That's like if you're going to go from Newcastle to Hull and you have to go via London, but on a much, much bigger scale. Yeah. So the World Cup is virtually upon us. Wednesday night, we've got the FIFA Congress and the big decision on World Cup 2026, which I guess there's no point going too much detail into now because basically it's going to be US or Morocco. Either way, there'll be a massive storm. Mm.
The reckoning is the US are going to pull it out of the bag now, aren't they?
They've got some friends to help them, let's put it that way. So I think that's going to play out on Wednesday night. Hopefully we'll be able to deal with that in a podcast late on Wednesday night. The plan still is, dear listener, subscribers, that we will do a podcast every day from Russia. I am somehow responsible for that, so it's going to be very difficult. I've never edited a podcast before, but I am sure it's going to be fine. I'm sure it can't be too difficult. We usually do everything in one take anyway.
To get the libel.
It's just the libelous stuff. The swear words can stay. And we will also be obviously getting phone calls in from Jack Pitt-Brook, who will be following England round. Where are they going? Kaliningrad, Nizhny Novgorod.
Their first game is in Volgograd.
Volgograd, Nizhny Novgorod, and Kaliningrad.
Yeah.
Three of the weirder cities.
We were just discussing this before we came on, though. I think there's an element of niceness about that, and that maybe that's what a World Cup should be to an extent, and going to places like the places you wouldn't normally go, venues you wouldn't normally see.
But who's the you when you're talking about where you wouldn't normally go? Because are many fans going to travel? It is fundamentally a weird tournament because, and we were saying this before, no one knows what's going to go down in Russia. And I think, obviously, the most likely scenario by miles is that it's just a normal football tournament. It goes off without incident, you know?
Well, do you remember, South Africa was my first World Cup, and you remember for months beforehand, there was so much talk, and obviously it's a different context, but there was so much talk about kind of the crime, murder rate in South Africa, and, you know, the potential for this to go badly wrong.
The same before Brazil as well.
And like, it's just, and the tournament passed off really serenely. It was a great experience. And it's kind of the thing about World Cups. And actually, I was thinking about this in relation to, obviously, the vast amount of politics in relation to this World Cup. They're almost a pre-World Cup discussion, because once the football starts, the football actually takes over, takes a life of its own. Then doesn't become so much about the host country, it's just about the game itself.
Yeah, so we might get, you know, I think most likely, obviously, everything passes off without incident. I said, you know, there is a scenario where down the line we look back and it's like, why did all these people, or these Western people, so willingly stroll into a country with whom kind of the West is virtually at war right now? It is peculiar, especially when the increasingly obvious how do you describe it? Like the stuff in the Sunday Times this weekend, is it increasingly obvious that Putin and Russia had an enormous influence in breaking up the EU, convincing Britain to leave the EU in the Brexit vote, whatever they've done to America, you know, where they've essentially driven a wedge between America and most of their big Western allies, the G8, by putting Trump in the White House and the absolute lunacy that's going on there. So it is peculiar that it's held in Russia. And this was something we never could have foreseen 10 years ago, kind of when they won it.
This is also the thing, I mean, it's definitely the most politicized World Cup since 1978, but in a different way because it's much more international. I mean, it was actually last night, a friend sent me on the speech by the Argentine dictator in 78 to open the ceremony, and he's talking about, you know, a tournament of inclusion and and unity, and this is at the same time as the secret police are throwing people out of planes into the South Atlantic.
Yeah.
So it's.
Well, did you read the piece in the Observer about? It was comparing this to the 1938 Olympics, which is obviously.
So that was a bit strong.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was kind of my thought process was, yeah, that is too strong. But what if it's not far behind?
Yeah.
What if it is not far behind? What if we are heading into something we shouldn't be? But then I was actually discussing this with a friend last night. And where I come down on it is, if we are strolling into, we're not strolling into 1938 Berlin, but if we're strolling into a situation of historic significance, I want to make sure the history's recorded correctly. You know, and I think there is a peculiar context to Russia hosting it, and the whole thing is very weird. But I think that Russia's main priority, actually, out of this whole World Cup, is that nothing should happen that would shame Russia.
Yeah,
and that's why I expect it to go off pretty much without incident. We should move on to the football, just because you could spend an hour talking about this stuff.
Yeah.
And
that's what we're saying. And
that isn't why people listen to it. the podcast, you know, the Indie Russia podcast is coming in October 2018. So what do you think then, heading into this World Cup, what are the major themes that stand out, that pop out at you?
First of all, I actually think this is, for all the talk about, or the justifiable talk about the decline of the international game compared to the club game and all that, I think this actually could be the strongest World Cup in decades, maybe. There's probably no team at the level of Spain 2010 or France 2000, say, that actually won the Euros 2 years after 98. But I think the quality of the top 6 to 8 sides, maybe particularly top 6, is ridiculously high. I actually think that's connected to the club game, because basically the major European nations, France, Germany, Spain, now England, if a little more belatedly, which is why a lot of people on the continent now think England will be winning international tournaments in the next decade. But they basically got their act together and started essentially industrializing talent production. So it's what we see now. So I think it has... one of the trends of recent World Cups is almost kind of... A group stage has it quite vibrant because of the group stage. It's the wall-to-wall football that we all love. But then it kind of tapers out as a tension takes over as the competition goes on. There's kind of some underwhelming knockout games. I think hopefully it could actually be the opposite this time, where we have an epic last eight. And I think... Because it doesn't actually happen that often where... The last eight is really filled with all the heavyweights. The way the draw is panned out, it is set up for that.
But you do sometimes get like a, say, Brazil versus Mexico, which is like, it's fine, but it's like, you know, Mexico are always going to be underdogs against Brazil, and you prefer the games like that to be in the round of 16. But I feel like I kind of
Chile like Brazil last time, that was great.
There are about 8, 9, 10 good teams.
Yeah.
So it would be good to see that. I think we also probably expect to see. We've talked about how teams will be more defensive and stuff. I think that's pretty much a given. We've talked extensively about international football. But what I believe is that teams who have kind of lots of... There are plenty of teams that have just one kind of standout player.
Mm.
And I think lots of these teams are basically setting their team up to allow that one player to shine.
Yeah.
And we've seen it with Brazil before. Argentina obviously build everything around and with a view to Messi making them successful and to being successful for Messi and with Messi. Colombia, James Rodriguez, and obviously Falcao, but I still think that's going to be Falcao. I think that's going to be James's team.
Yeah.
Whereas when they went into 2014 and it was Falcao's team enormously, he was the best striker in the world at the point, and then he gets that tragic injury and it became James's team. And originally he was playing on the left of a 4-2-2-2, and it thrust him centre stage in every possible way. And then he had one of the great World Cups, really, actually. I think individually as a player, James was extraordinary in Brazil. So I think we might see these teams setting up to make one player really stand out.
The one thing I was thinking about when I was doing my preview, which I have to say, for when I was writing it for the first time, I got really excited about the World Cup. But the expectation, maybe what, like, I suppose 2010 was a very defensive tournament in general. Euro 2016 was a very defensive tournament. I think maybe the expectation would have been for this trend to continue. Yet in 2014, that was a really, really attacking group stage. And maybe, the hope is this might be similar. I mean, it does feel like maybe bar Uruguay, the South American teams haven't become as kind of as cautious as mid-tier European sides.
South American qualifying is so much harder than the European one, I think. The level of football is very competitive. Or even, like, because even the bad teams away from home are really difficult to beat.
Yeah.
So, I think that, you know, usually we have, like, a Paraguay who are really, really solid and run
always
loads. They're really dull, but yeah, but, you know, they're solid. Like,
when was the last good Paraguay World Cup
game? Of course. But they are fundamentally a team that is just rugged and difficult to beat. Chile, obviously, missing is tough, but they're not quite as exciting as you know, they're not the São Paulo and Bielsa team that everyone's fallen in love with. They're not the team that finally gave Chile a footballing identity. So what have we got? We've got Colombia, who are a fascinating team. They've got a great coach in Peckerman. They've got some very good players. Mm. They've got some obvious weaknesses. And that's pretty much a blueprint, I think, for a lot of those second-tier teams. There are lots of teams with obvious weaknesses. How many squads do you reckon who you look at their first 11, you think, okay, bang, there's not really an obvious black hole there? And I'd say it's probably like France, Spain.
Spain, yeah. Brazil. Especially Spain of Diego Costa.
Right, but did you read the Diego Torres piece about this?
No.
Diego Torres wrote a very good piece about how Costa is a great striker for a team that is defensive and reactive and counter-attacking, and that will never fit with what Spain does. Yeah. And that's what Spain have had a great trouble over the last 4 or 5 years, basically post-Villa, finding someone to play in the number 9 position.
I was researching last week. I was watching a lot of the Spain 2010 stuff. And when you look back at it, first of all, Villa is basically the perfect fit. It's amazing how it all came together for them. He's a perfect fit for that team. But I mean, that must have been probably the most balanced. I think in terms of the quality of the 11, how it fits together, one of the best sides ever. And not just in terms of the success, I mean, but how well. It was such a perfect football unit.
Well, you know, and the thing with Villa, like, and what happened when he went to Barcelona, he started playing from the left.
Yeah.
Because it opens up such different possibilities for you. And I half think Lopetegui might try that with someone like Rodrigo Moreno.
Yeah.
Basically having a centre forward coming off the flank, because they've had so many problems just trying to find someone who could play through the middle.
I was talking to someone in UEFA about 2 weeks ago, and they were talking about a seminar they were at with Vicente del Bosque shortly after Euro 2012. And one of the big discussions was during that tournament was playing without a striker. And del Bosque was kind of open, talking about how, we just didn't have a player, a striker of sufficient fitness or form at that time to play with our system. So people said it was defensive or whatever. What it was how he explained how, basically, with so many attacking players, they would constantly move the ball from left to right, knowing that eventually the space would open for one of them to get in.
Yeah, and I think it's why I'm interested in how Spain does, because they've got players who can make the most of that. It's still difficult. There are still question marks over Lopetegui. I think he's good, but there are still question marks over him, obviously. I mean, we talked about this in podcasts past, but I think we should probably talk about your big preview that you've done. That's on the website now. It has got you excited for the World Cup, etc. It brings together a lot of the themes of this, which are, this is an event that, the World Cup is an event that unites a lot of people, isn't it? It's a very rare event where, and I think you wrote in there that it feels like, and when you're at a game at the World Cup, you do feel like the eyes of the world are on this game. Yeah. The entire world, the entire footballing world is watching this game, which you never feel even if you're at like a Man United Liverpool, you never feel quite like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's very few occasions. The Champions League final, 100 metres final of the Olympics, World Cup games, are kind of the few occasions where you do really feel like, wow, the world is watching.
Well, I think I went through some of the stats, and like in so many countries, some of the, you know, the most watched broadcasts in history are still kind of World Cup matches.
Yeah,
and even in England or the UK, it's actually the 1966 final trumps Diana's funeral by 200,000 people. Apparently,
I mean, just while Johnny's not here for another reprisal of our half-hour dissection of Diana's funeral, but this World Cup is, you know, we say it's different. But the fact is that I think people will still be excited for this as ever. We're kind of in a time where football and footballers particularly have the biggest brands they've ever had.
Yeah.
And we still have in this World Cup some of the biggest names in sport that are going to be there. More looking at the possibility for who's going to win it, who's going to do well, who's going to not do well. Do you think there's a big gap in terms of quality? Do you think... I was looking at the teams. I think Brazil are clearly the favourites. And I think that's reflected in the odds. I think Brazil have the combination... I know you're in love with Spain, but Brazil...
Funny that.
Yeah, Brazil have...
objectively speaking.
Yes.
analytically speaking.
Yes, and if Ireland were there, they'd be your second favourite. Brazil are I think they've got the best combination of coach and a really good team.
Yeah.
Which is massive. I think Spain have a really good team. Question mark over the striker position, not because of the quality of players there, but just because they haven't made that position work for like 3, 4, 5 years now, which is a concern. Lopetegui, I'm willing to believe he's good, but we've seen him fail elsewhere at Porto. France, really good squad, like probably the deepest squad, but Didier Deschamps, I'm still not having it.
When you watch France, and this even got, I mean, Pogba in some ways personifies their entire problem. It feels like they've got so many talents, but Deschamps doesn't feel like completely equipped to make the best out of them. I mean, they've arguably, them and maybe England, have got the fastest team of the tournament among the top tier. But like it doesn't feel like they can completely utilise that.
Players who have played under him that I've talked to just don't rate Deschamps. They really don't think he's good. And it would have been interesting if they'd come in with someone else. They haven't. So France are kind of in that same bracket for me. Argentina, a bracket below that because there are such obvious holes in that squad. But they have got Messi. I believe they can do anything with him.
Yeah, exactly. No,
we've seen it
agree.
Before, 4 years ago.
The one thing, though, with Sampaoli, I mean, he's probably one of the best coaches of the tournament. But I do wonder, is it almost that kind of... nothing just quite fits up with the way it should be, as in they've finally appointed the right coach when they should have done this kind of 4 or 5 years ago. I mean, he probably would have been ideal for one of those Copa Americas they had, but now they have him and he wants to play a specific style of football when he doesn't have the defenders, and when he doesn't need to kind of front load an attack because he's got it. Almost feels like they should actually do what they did in 2014 and basically just, when you've got Messi, keep things tight.
Sabella.
Yeah. And keep things as tight as possible and let Messi do it.
The thing is, they have got the right coach in Sampaoli. They've got the best coach that they could have got, I think. But
probably Simeone.
As I said, that would have required that job share thing, which I don't think Atletico would have ever agreed to. They aren't necessarily... They don't look like a Sampaoli team yet. I don't think he's had enough time to get into them what he wants. I think when he took over, they just had to get to the tournament. Yeah. So it wasn't really about try and play my way. It's just like, let's just get the wins we need. And they win that last qualifier away at Ecuador, which is massive because it's a tough place to go. And suddenly they're there. Great. So you've got six friendlies. You've got three international breaks. They've got February, March, and then this one.
Yeah.
So that's six friendlies you get. In those friendlies, they beat a rubbish Italy side that failed to qualify for the World Cup. Couple of average results.
Thrashed by
Spain.
Got
smashed by Spain.
You know, the only bit that Spain game, it was relatively even first half. Then Spain got ahead and they made loads of changes, and that was
fair enough. Yeah. But they got beaten by Spain. Like they got properly beaten by Spain. And then their World Cup warm up games, they played Haiti.
Well. Yeah.
And then their trip to Israel was cancelled for a variety of reasons. But fundamentally, their preparation has been one of the worst of any of the teams. They've now lost Manuel Lanzini. I don't think that's a big deal for them.
Although Messi really likes Lanzini, doesn't he?
Yeah, but I just think footballistically it's not a big absence. It looks like Enzo Perez is going to come in for them, which actually I think is a good idea because they probably had too many attacking players and they could have done with one more at proper central midfielder. So Enzo coming back in, that works for me. The defence is what I worry about. It's just slow more than anything. And there are some fast, good players at this World Cup. And when you get to the late stages, they will expose you. Like Gabriel Mercado was like a okay player at River, and he went to Sevilla, and he's done okay.
They're on the same side of the draw as France, aren't they? Imagine Mbappe against that defence.
Well, besides Federico Fazio, and I think we saw Liverpool Roma exactly how exposed he could be by speed. So, yeah, there are problems with that team, and then just below that, I think Belgium, England, Portugal are kind of on the same tier. England. Yeah, they're probably one of the 8 to 10 best teams there. So quarterfinals would be a good sort of place for them to be.
And I think even about England, it's almost not necessarily about how they finish. Obviously, semi-finals, that would be great. And a quarterfinal would be the first time they've done it at a World Cup since 2006. That standard kind of level that they used to kind of be almost criticised. Now they just want to get back to. But it almost feels like what is important about England's World Cup is the vibe of it, that they actually kind of put on a bit of show.
It's an incredible positivity that I can barely remember a positivity like this around an England squad. And I think Gareth Southgate should take huge credit for that. It only dawned on me, I think, walking to work this morning, that he's the first former England player to be coached since Hoddle. Is that right?
Yes, I think so.
I just wonder if that makes a difference. He's been to a modern tournament, you know? He gets it, I think, a little bit more. He's a little closer in age to those guys. He's very calm. He's very
collected. He's really good, I think,
You know, I'd never... before he was England manager, I met him a few times, but when we met him and talked to him after England-Scotland in Glasgow, that game, the weird game where Lee Griffith suddenly became a superhero, really struck me how impressive he was speaking. And, you know, speaking isn't everything. There have been loads of good speakers who are rubbish coaches, but it bought him enough credit in my mind to give him a good shot. I think he's built this team well, this 3-5-2, which is kind of, it was semi-built like Spurs, wasn't it? Let's be honest, because they had a lot of Spurs players in there. I like that he's basically deliberately tried to build a system that will work against weaker teams that sit back. But if he flips that midfield triangle, then he can use it against the good teams in the quarterfinals. And because you have to be able to play both ways in the World Cup because of what we were talking about earlier, the discrepancy in quality between some of the teams. You don't want to have to find a completely new shape and strategy in 2 days before playing Brazil when you've used a different formation throughout the group stage. Yeah. And that what it kind of leads into, I guess, the point that this isn't the best football on the planet. Johnny's column on Friday was, is the World Cup still the pinnacle of football? And the answer is
no.
Fairly comprehensively no. But what your preview, which everyone should go and read, I mean, they're both on the website, obviously, or in the usual places on social media, Johnny's column about the pinnacle and Miguel's massive preview, which in, what, how many words? 1,200 words-ish, you managed to pretty much distill kind of all the strands going into this World Cup. And I just think, rather than just recreate it on the podcast, people should go and read it to understand what we're talking about. So do you think that it matters that this isn't the pinnacle of football anymore?
No, because I think it's still, and I mentioned this in the piece, it's still the pinnacle of sport in terms of emotion. I mean, even when it comes right down to it, like the actual significance, I mean, for the distinctive trophy, and I think it's actually so fitting that the trophy itself is so unique, because it represents something great. I mean, to be even, like, having spoken to kind of over the last few weeks and done a fair bit of research on obviously the history tournament, but having spoken to kind of like previous champions and all that, like the sense of awe even they still have, kind of just the idea of on the champion of the world to hold that trophy, to touch it. I mean, I was watching that documentary last week, the one about the 2010 Spain side, as we referenced earlier. And like even the way Iker Casillas and Villa just like they're almost kind of lost for words in describing the significance of the trophy. And I suppose that's what it kind of is getting into in the piece, and we mentioned earlier, the eyes of the world, Ronnie. There's like I mean, it trumps the Olympics in terms of world appeal. It's basically the sporting occasion that means the most to the most people, with, like, you know, kind of, I suppose, elements of nationalism and representing your country, kind of further maximizing that. So that it does have this kind of this transcendent quality to it, and it just feels like it means more, even if the level isn't as good. And I suppose only adding to that is the fact it's kind of has the rarity value of being every 4 years. Champions League is every year instead, and it feels like it's on a higher plane in that regard.
And it is kind of what you mentioned in the piece. It's immortality.
Yeah. Well, this is it. I mean, the other thing, a much more kind of simple joy about the World Cup. If you think about it, like, I think it's true. People measure their lives by World Cup. If someone said to you a famous World Cup moment, like, say, Zidane's headbutt or his header in 98, you're going to remember what you were doing around that time in your life, what was going on. You know, so you're kind of, you key events from your own life are anchored to the World Cup.
It's completely true. And this came to me the other day when I was filling out something about, I was talking about World Cup memories. And at the time, I didn't think much of the 2006 World Cup. You know what I mean? I was like 16, 17 years old. I was at sick form, I think. And kind of what it gave us was opportunities to go around to our friend's house when their parents weren't there and drink and have a barbecue and watch football matches and stuff, and like miss the afternoon off school, and it was great, and it was like, it was brilliant, absolutely fantastic, like the greatest time. But it was just a thing, you know, and you carried on, and then like, when it finished, the rest of the summer you did whatever. But now I look back on it, and it's a real kind of signpost in your life for every single one. In 2010 is a different signpost, and 2014 was the first one I went to, and that was obviously a completely different experience to sitting at home and watching it. And World Cup 98, I remember watching it it was the first proper World Cup, because 94 I was just a little young. But World Cup 98, I remember watching the first game, Brazil Scotland, and the main thing is the colours.
I just remember how
bright the colours were. Brazil's bright yellow shirt. And it was a really sunny day, and the grass, presumably it was Saint Denis, was bright green.
Yeah.
And then the sea of dark blue Scottish shirts. Mm. And then César Sampaio nods home, and then John Collins scores a penalty. And then Brazil come back and win it. But it was just that first World Cup that I remember.
The bright technicolour sunshine is actually quite key to it as well, I think.
It is, more than anything, and actually it's something you don't really talk about, we haven't talked about that much with reference to the World Cup, is it is summer. You know, the summer element is actually quite crucial because it gives it these incredible visuals.
Yeah.
And I guess it's only just, maybe it's less pronounced now because we're so used to this. Mm-hmm. And I've actually noticed it on Champions League nights where, you know, you've got these bright floodlights.
Yeah.
And it just focuses on like the Bernabeu pitch, and you've got Real Madrid against someone else, like Liverpool, for example. It'd be bright red, bright white, bright green. And we've got HD TVs everywhere now, so everyone's used to it. But I think back in the day, it wasn't. Back in the day, we had these crap TVs, you know, and you've got a 16-inch big box in your bedroom. And
that's why it said 1970 was, the fact it was the first in colour, broadcast colour, actually, you know, maximised the effect of what Brazil did and all that.
Absolutely. It's aesthetics. And that's what lodges it in people's memories, because a lot of people have visual memories, you know, where it's remembering what they're seeing, and they're sat in a living room looking at a tiny little TV, and all I can see these bright, beautiful colours and you know, the famous Brazil goal.
Yeah.
And that motion and colour and emotion stuff, that's what lodges it in people's minds. And I think I kind of feel like this World Cup feels less sentimental going into it, obviously, partially because those memories haven't been made yet. But do you think this World Cup feels set up for disappointment?
I actually think it's going to be a good World Cup, and I think, because there has been a strange feeling, and even the way I'm referencing myself, I only started probably getting excited on Friday, despite the fact it was within a week of me going, when I started writing my preview. But I was actually just on like a few WhatsApp groups. I kind of, you know, texted my mates from home, and I was wondering, just, are you guys excited about the World Cup? One of them immediately responds, any news on Fekir to Liverpool?
Yeah.
the club game has kind of, you know, dominated to that degree. But, and I think, talking to a few people, there are a lot like that. It's like they haven't kind of, Maybe it's the fact that the Champions League final was only 2 weeks ago, and the club game has consumed such an extent. I mean, one thing, I think Ken Early discussed this, but I remember in the build-up to 98, from kind of March on, there's tons of World Cup ads. Same with 2002, where it just, maybe it's changing the kind of media as well.
I think you're absolutely spot on. I saw something with someone on the commercial side of sport recently, very high up on the commercial side of sport. And he said they've already received more briefs and stuff for the Women's World Cup next summer than for the World Cup this summer.
Well,
now there are a few reasons for that. I think brands see the positive side of being associated with women's football. I think it, you know, it looks inclusive. It's growing. It's cheaper. All of the things you think. It's in France. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a much more friendly tournament to be around, to be associated with, especially. You know, I think there are far more openly gay footballers in women's football than there are in men's football. And with Russia, obviously that is a concern. That is a problem. Russia has its own image problem, I guess, is the only way to put it. And brands might not necessarily... considering brands are usually falling over themselves to be associated with these big football tournaments. And I mean, every possible brand. I mean, washing up liquids, chocolate bars, whatever. They're all falling over themselves. There is less of that this summer. What, you know, what they call brand activation and stuff. There was a lot less of that around. So, right.
When I was growing up, I remember like the tenuous link, some kind of like chocolate bars everyone would try to kind of connect themselves to the World Cup.
Oh, of course. You know, like the Joe Hart Mars Bar adverts and stuff.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
But these, you know, and there's also the thing that brands aren't allowed to use certain words to advertise.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So like, I saw an advert for one of the bookmakers yesterday, which was like trying to be a World Cup advert without using the words World Cup, Russia,
the great
2018
festival of
summer.
Football.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, oh, the foot goal. You know, like, and you're going to see some of that for sure. Mm. But I do think there's less of a build-up, certainly less than before Brazil. Before Brazil, when I was with a previous employer, we had a thing for months before, which was a series every Monday after the Premier League weekend. And it was like, which England player would help their claim to the squad, which England player had diminished it. And we had this interactive thing called On the Plane, where you could, it was like an airport departures board, where you could put your players in and fill the squad out. I've not seen much of that this year.
No,
I just feel like there's much less of a build-up, much less of an interest in who England are taking and stuff. And the Premier League and the Champions League has completely taken over. Perhaps if the title had been done really early like it was, but there was no English interest in the Champions League, we would have been more on that.
Yeah.
Instead, it doesn't feel like that's been the case. It feels like this World Cup has kind of snuck up on
a bit of
people.
That. Yeah. But I think that's why, and I do think it will be good. I think it will be better than Euro 2016. I think people...
Did you know, what was wrong with Euro 2016?
I think it was actually... France was great. It was in terms of off the pitch...
Incredible host.
It was the best tournament I've been to.
Yeah.
just on the pitch, it was mostly a dull tournament. It kind of summed up with the final, which was kind of a strange game. There was some good moments too, obviously, but it was quite defensive.
There is an element, and I think I might write something to this effect this week, probably when I'm feeling sentimental on the plane, is that... These things don't come around very often. You know, I don't know if I want to go to the next World Cup in Qatar. That's one I really don't agree with at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I don't know where I'm going to be in 2026 for a start. I'm going to be bloody old.
I was actually thinking there's probably a piece to do in this as well on the arrangement we make with ourselves and the World Cup to watch if there are ethical dimensions. I mean, I suppose as journalists, we're in a different situation because, I mean, there's the old argument whether you should boycott covering Qatar or even Russia. But yet, at the same time, as a journalist, even if you are just a sports journalist as opposed to a news journalist there, you have a duty to cover it. But it is probably how much you're willing to overlook for the sake of...
And I think there can be an overblown sense of duty when you're a sports journalist. You know, sport isn't life and death most of the time. When it is, obviously, that's somewhat... somewhat rare, but also a circumstance in which you just have to be there in the instant. But I don't equate Russia and Qatar quite. I think they're slightly different things. Like, for me, Russia would be a legitimate host, even if they might not have won the bid in the most straight way. Qatar was never a legitimate host, and on top of that, I think that, you know, the human rights abuses and things that go on there are far worse. But
I was discussing this with someone yesterday just about how the argument about who gets to host the World Cup, and like, it's one of the, we were talking about the usual predictable response is, oh, well, where do you draw the line? I mean, look what, you know, Britain or US are involved in, kind of, in terms of kind of foreign military interventions. But, and you know, that is a fair question, but still, it's bit of overblown moral relativism. I mean, probably the line should really be a country's relationship with human rights.
Yes.
Which, I mean, it's questionable with both of the hosts in 2018 and particularly 2022.
Yeah. But the main thing for me with this, and I know it's not an easy sell going into Russia and all these things, but it is the World Cup. Mm-hmm. And the world has got a lot worse in the last 2 years. Basically, the start of Euro 2016, it's hard to remember this, the start of Euro 2016, things were much simpler.
Britain was in the EU.
It was during that. I remember very vividly waking up in Nice. I think it was I'd been at Italy, Sweden the night before Zlatan's final international game. And I woke up and I had a lot of angry texts from people. And,
yeah.
And, you know, that all hell broke loose, and I ended up spending like 8 hours on a baking hot train that day. Just no one had a clue what was going on, and I was living in Spain actually at the time as well, so it was more of a like, what happens now? Because am I gonna have to move back to London? Like, what's the situation? But that was only the start, really.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
was 6 months down the line.
Yeah, 6 months down the line.
Although, of course, according to one former Labour spokesman who's prominent on social media, concern over Brexit is more than a middle class lifestyle concern.
Yes, well, I mean, he knows what he is. I think, you know, beyond the Brexit thing, then you have the Trump stuff. We've got people like Viktor Orban in Hungary who are deeply, deeply concerning individuals.
And I suppose key to that is the focus put on Russia within all of this. I mean, the kind of, you know, the subtle power of you.
But this is why it's significant. The relations with Russia in early 2016, 2015 weren't that bad. There was a big issue over Ukraine, which is right. And that is my, you know, one of my biggest concerns about Russia is they are still occupying, you know, a sovereign state, basically. And not to mention, if you want to go into the other areas, Crimea, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, all of these places, not to mention Chechnya, Tatarstan, you know, it's a big thing, obviously, in the former Soviet Union. But because of Russia's role in that, which is now becoming open to the public, I think lots of people have thought it for a long time. And I think in the intelligence communities and stuff, I think they've known these things, obviously, a long time before the public, that Russia played a role in some of the way that these things have unraveled, which is why there is this tenseness and there is this different relationship going into Russia this summer. There's a lot of pretty grim stuff going on in the world, and there's quite often it feels like there's not much of a release from that.
Yeah.
Because it is an unrelenting front page catalogue of doom. And for 1 month, we might have an opportunity to kind of push it aside at least.
The global party, that's what it is, yeah.
You know, and I don't think Russia itself is going to be the global party that, say, Brazil was.
Yeah.
You know, because Brazil did feel like it felt special because... And Brazil, again, unique because... okay, there weren't a huge amount of Europeans actually there. But 100,000 Colombians drove across for their first game at the World Cup since 98. All the Chileans that drove, the Argentinians and stuff.
Again, my highlight of that tournament, I suppose, probably the many times you heard...
The Argentinians made that World Cup in many ways. And you know, I say I love the Chileans coming across. The Uruguayans making the trip and the whole Suarez thing was incredible. But this won't have the party feel, I don't think, on the ground in Russia. But what I think this might be for a lot of people is the glorious distraction.
Yeah.
This is the glorious distraction. And we can look away from, like, all... Because it's great. It's very grating, all these things that are fundamentally depressing things.
Yeah.
And things that normal people like us have no control over. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we, you know, watch football and we go to the pub and we, like, see friends, play five-a-side, go on holiday, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, that's our lives. We can't control things like Brexit and foreign elections and all these sorts of things, and you see all these terrible things going on and you are kind of powerless to them all. But what we can do is kind of just get stuck into a World Cup, which is going to show the best and worst of people in sport. And I'm kind of in for that now. I'm pretty sick of all the other stuff that's gone on around it. Like, personally, I feel like we've put so much into this World Cup now in terms of like a year of planning and that I'm ready to just get there and for the football to start. I can't wait for Russia, Saudi Arabia, just because it's it's underway. Mm. Once the ball started rolling, we react to everything. At the moment, it's all planning.
Yeah,
planning's the worst.
Yeah.
I hate planning. Reacting and looking at what's happened and why it's interesting and explaining it in the context of everything that's gone on is what's this World Cup's going to be about. And as I say, hopefully just a step away from the kind of, not the misery of everyday life, because that sounds pretty grim, but it's certainly a step away from the humdrum, you know. And if I was just in an office, you know, which a lot of people I know are going to be working in offices and stuff like that, you got the BBC website up, you're watching like whoever it is, Senegal against Poland, and a tiny little window in the top corner thing. Like, that's kind of like, it's just a little relief. It's just a little relief for, even that's just from your day job, even that's just between 2 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon while your boss is out, being able to snatch 45 minutes of Sadio Mane shredding Gregor Kukoviak or whatever. It's fun, because you're never going to see that. You're never going to see that again. In the same way that teams have qualified for this World Cup for the first time in ages, there might be teams here who don't qualify for another World Cup for 20 years.
Yeah.
And that's important. That's important for these countries.
Especially having grown up in a smaller country, and that's my first World Cup memory. I was probably 1990. I was probably too young. I was six, so too young to consume the World Cup in the way kind of you really do as a kid, which I really did in 1994, like, taking every detail in. But I can still vividly remember everything around all the Irish games, and like, there was the fervour around it was like nothing I've ever seen since. Because it was a first World Cup. It was so huge.
Yeah. The golden generation World Cups where England were actually, there was expectation on England, were quite something.
Yeah.
In my memory, the weather was always glorious as well, which doesn't seem right for England, but they were.
Yeah.
And you look at the team at the 2006 World Cup and the names in there, like the Beckham, Scholes, Lampard, Gerrard, Owen, Rooney, all these guys, it's like, England did have a hell of a good team.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, the 0-2 teams, I think Jack Pitt-Brooks sent us those teams the other day.
Yeah.
And he's actually calling me, so we should ring him in a second to talk about England. But those teams from the 2002 World Cup quarter-final were just absolutely mind-blowing. Yeah.
Bar Danny Mills, Heskey.
Be nice to Emil.
And, that's saying they weren't good players and what they did, but when we're talking about the star level of the players, there's kind of it's quite incongruous. And the three, I think Trevor Sinclair as well, who was all three good, useful players serving a tactical role in the team. But when you're kind of thinking of the star quality of the side, they wouldn't necessarily match up. Also, Roque Jr. was in the Brazilian side, but anyway, they were still brilliant teams. And
AC Milan's Roque Jr. As opposed to Leeds United's Roque Jr. We should ring Jack, just to get him in. So if you allow me to dial the phone, and hopefully he'll be up in a second. Okay, Jack, hello. I think I've got you. How are you doing, first of all? And you're at Heathrow now, so are you looking forward to jetting off?
Hi Ed, I'm very well thanks. I'm currently at Heathrow Terminal 5, just about to fly to St Petersburg, from where I'll go on to Rapino, where England are based. And I'll be covering the England team, their press conferences, all of their games for as long as they're in the tournament, as well as doing other matches in St Petersburg. Having never been to a World Cup before, I'm very, very excited.
Jack, what do you think are the expectations within the England camp itself as regards how they'll perform?
I'd say there's a very positive atmosphere in the England camp. Positive rather than having a strong expectations in terms of doing well. But I think that both from Southgate and the young sort of forward-looking squad that he has picked means that England are hopeful of playing well. They're hopeful of entertaining people. I don't think they necessarily expect to win it, or maybe to make it even to make it into the semis or the final. But it does feel like there's a big atmosphere change compared to the last few tournaments that England have been in, regardless of how well they actually do.
I mean, that seems about right. But what do you expect from them personally? Like, is a quarterfinal success? Because that's what everyone's talking about.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? There seems to be a real kind of unanimity of expectations from certainly people outside the camp, which is quarterfinals, both in the sense of thinking that's how well England will do, but also thinking that that would be a success. I mean, it would be a disaster if they were not to get out of the group. But that said, I do think that this England team, given how they play and the speed with which they move the ball, are actually better equipped to beat teams like Tunisia and Panama than they have been for years. I mean, who can forget England 0 Slovakia 0 in 2016, or England 0 Algeria 0 in 2010, or England 0 Costa Rica 0 in 2014. I'm kind of confident that England will win a few games well in the group stage. And to be honest, I think that is a big part of what people want from this England team, right? It's people want this England team to just play well once or twice and put two or three goals past the lesser team, which sounds really easy, but obviously England have found it hard. Then in the last 16, we'd have one out of Poland, Colombia, Senegal, Japan. I think England, Colombia would be a great game. I think that would probably be a 50-50. You'd have to give England a very good chance of going through there. And then obviously, a quarterfinal against a much stronger team, probably Germany or Brazil, I think. And, I don't think we would go into that game with much of an expectation of England winning. But if we were to do that, if we were to get through to a quarterfinal and lose to a much stronger team, that would be seen as a big success. I mean, it would obviously be our first quarterfinal in a World Cup since 2006, England had a much, much stronger team. And I think people would be pretty happy with that as an outcome. I mean, obviously, who knows how things will turn out over the next few weeks. And, England might go out under very different circumstances. But, plotting out that, what I think is probably the most likely route at the World Cup, I think people would be okay with that.
And away from England, who are you fancying to do some damage?
I think my personal tip for the World Cup is Spain. I just think they've got so much experience, the experience of winning those three tournaments in a row. They now have the best goalkeeper in the world. They've got so much strength and depth in midfield. I guess the only question you would ask of them is centre-forward. Famously, they took an unfit Diego Costa to Brazil 4 years ago, and it didn't really work out. But then I wonder whether their failure there was more to do with the end of the kind of Del Bosque era than Costa himself. If they can get Costa fit and firing, then I would certainly make them favourites. Even without Costa, you wonder whether they might be able to play without a centre forward as they did, as they did in 2012. Lots of people like Brazil. I think I'd be a bit reluctant to say them because, I mean, it'd be interesting to see how sharp Neymar is, having not played for a few months. And also the loss of Dani Alves and having to play Danilo instead, who's nowhere near as good, might hurt them. Although they do have so much experience and quality. Beyond that, I don't know. I mean, I think we'd all love to see Argentina win it, particularly inspired by Lionel Messi, but you wonder how much they have in other parts of the team. Germany, I'm not particularly excited by. France have got some fantastic players, but you do wonder where. I mean, the big question for me in Euro 2016 was, can you get the most out of Pogba and Griezmann at the same time? Because Pogba wants to play in sort of number 10 and Griezmann wants to drop off as a second striker, and it's difficult to make the two work together. Those are my unoriginal picks, but I'd if I had to pick one, I'd say Spain.
Okay, one final question. Who is the one player you'd like to have a big World Cup?
I'd love to see David Silva and Andres Iniesta have one last great World Cup. Obviously Iniesta is slightly older and has now left European club football. But, you know, they are two all-time greats who we've all loved watching for the last 10 to 12 years. So that they really stand out. Beyond that, to be honest, I'd love to see Paul Pogba have a great World Cup. You know, it seems stupid that you have to say this, but he's an incredible player. Like, I know it's not worked out for him at United and under Jose Mourinho, but there's not really anyone else like him in the world game. And he's such a big figure and big person that I'd be thrilling to see him really take some games by control by himself. And I think that's it, really. Oh, yeah, and James Rodriguez. I mean, he's kind of not really done anything since those amazing games for Colombia 4 years ago. But again, he's still young. He's still very talented. I remember actually writing a piece during the 2014 World Cup saying, Neymar might be good now, but James is going to be the biggest star of the next 4 years, which, even by the standards of my predictions, turned out to be a particularly bad one. But if he could have a few good games for Colombia, that would be great to see, even if it might come at England's expense in the last 16.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you, mate. I will possibly see you in Russia. You'll definitely bump into Miguel. I'm not sure if...
We'll be doing England-Belgium together.
Yes, group stage, yeah.
And the final. That's two we got confirmed. So
The one I might see him if England do the round of 16 at Spartak Stadium. I think that requires them to finish second in their group. They would be playing against Colombia.
Otherwise, Rostov and Don if they finish top.
Or Senegal, probably.
But I'll be there. Next week, I'll be in Rostov and Don.
Indeed. And this time tomorrow, you and I will be on the plane to Russia.
Yeah.
Which probably feels...
Getting ready for Russia.
As good a time...
Can't help doing that in a Chris Waddle voice after 2016.
Do you not think... I mean, what's the one team you'd like to see win the World Cup? That's not a trick question.
Well, you know, I'm half Spanish, so...
All right, okay, that's cheating.
Spain. Argentina. I want Messi to win it.
Argentina, you call them, which I think the cross of Messi and Argentina works. What's the team you'd least like to see win the World Cup?
I think either Brazil or Germany, because both would be so boring. Brazil have won it 5 times and all that, and it feels like Chiche has obviously done a great job, and this is a good squad, but it still feels like it's one of these periodic things that there's still massive problems in Brazilian football, and this will just further allows them to kind of get away with it a bit.
Yeah.
And Germany's just a bit... I think about 2014, I was at 2014, and there was only two games where Germany played well, which one of them was obviously the 7-1, which is one of the greatest World Cup games ever. But it still felt like it just got to the point where, because they have more money than anyone, and because they've basically industrialised youth production in Germany, they just have this critical mass of quality, which means they'll always be thereabouts. And that was almost felt the case in 2014. I think afterwards, I think there might have been some phrase from Yogi Löw, and he said, this is the natural end of a process. Like, which kind of just, it's a bit, you know, feeling that it's a very mechanical thing to
it. You prefer football as art rather than some sort of scientific factory process, which I think is fair. I think, you know, lots of people do prefer to...
Nothing against Brazil or Germany as these nations. It would just be a bit like, oh, again.
I can get more on board with Brazil because I feel like they've hired a good coach who's actually going to try and do the right thing, and that's going to propel them to being better than some of their parts, which are usually quite good parts.
Although, having been in Brazil in 2014, a lot of the fervour around the Neymar injury and all that, and then the build-up to the semi-final, put me off a little bit. There was a bit of a...
Well, that was a very...
A bit of an arrogance about it.
Very intense period, a very difficult thing to happen for them. Who's the one player from any team that you'd love to see have a great World Cup?
I know, it's very obvious. I can't go for Messi.
I thought you were going to go for Iniesta.
I would like Iniesta as well, yeah.
If Iniesta really had like one of those World Cups where he was the standout player.
Is it anti-2006?
It would be a nice sort of bow out moment. Yeah.
But I think given a lot of the complete bollocks around the Messi debate, it would be not. I'd like to see it.
No, just, I agree. I agree. Basically, I think people that do believe Messi is the greatest footballer to have ever played the game, and I mean, he's certainly the greatest footballer of the modern era for me. I think comparing him with Pele is kind of pointless and impossible, really.
Yeah.
They're playing different sports almost. But for me, Messi is the greatest ever, and it would help kind of settle that.
Yeah.
I'm sure it never will settle that, you know. The player you'd least like to see have a really good World Cup?
That's a bit harsh on someone, isn't it?
Go on.
I haven't really thought about that.
Put them on the line.
I mean, I do like Ronaldo. I like him. I think he's obviously one of the best players ever. But because of, I think the way it fires this debate, if you do it like, I mean, the way Euro 2016 was painted, despite the fact that like he got injured in the final, because he watched as Eder won it, like, and yet it was painted what he's done on the international stage now. You know, it's just this is what it would lead into. But then, yeah. I like Ronaldo himself. So,
so it's Ronaldo. And finally, what do you really want out of this World Cup yourself?
A festival of football. I want an entertaining game.
I hope football is the winner.
Yeah, I really do hope football is the winner.
As dull and cliched an answer as Miguel Delaney could give you there. It's probably the best time to wrap things up. Do you have anything else you want to say before you depart?
Messi and Norma.
Like a programming note, I'd say absolutely. Ensure you stay tuned to
be sure to follow
football.
Us on all relevant social media channels.
I mean,
channels.
Like, we've put an incredible amount into this World Cup. I've nearly lost a lot of things over this World Cup, but including my marbles. But we've got, hopefully, podcasts every day from Russia, which I think no one else is going to be doing. We're going to have a ton of good content. We've already got a lot of that in the can. Great preview stuff. We're going to have a supplement coming out next week. I mean, stuff that's already out there. Miguel's massive preview, which you can read. Johnny's column, "Is the World Cup Still the Pinnacle of the Game?" Part two of his exclusive interview at home with Gary Lineker, talking about Lineker's World Cup experiences, which, as with Johnny's work, is exceptionally written, as always. Jack Pitbrook has done some absolutely brilliant, brilliant interviews before this, including one with Salif Jow on Senegal's 2002 World Cup campaign, which is obviously historically excellent for that country. Tim Borowski on Germany 2006. We've got Marcel Desailly and William Gallas talking about World Cup 98 and how France won that. There is so much stuff, way, way, way beyond all those things I've just said. We're going to have a World Cup newsletter every morning. So if you want a newsletter, which is going to be written personally, handwritten, actually not handwritten, on a laptop, but by one of us, that will be sent out every morning. So you've got that in your email inbox by 7 a.m. So if you're on the website, you'll see little sign-up boxes for that. Please make sure you sign up for that. We'll also make sure we tweet that out. If you're not following us on Twitter, it's at Indie Football or at Independent for the relevant guys, at Jack Pitbrook, at Miguel Delaney, at Jonathan Liu, at EAA Malian, at MJ Critchley. Like, they're the guys who are going to be out in Russia. We're also going to have stuff going on our Facebook page. So please search out The Independent Sport on Facebook. And obviously just the website. So there's going to be so much around. You're going to really want to make sure you don't miss it, because I think we're probably going to have the best coverage of any of the English titles going out there. As ever, thanks for listening. Thanks for listening all season long. The first season of the Indie Football Podcast. We get a lot of nice messages and the occasional nasty one, but yeah, certainly the numbers are on our side in that case. And if you're not already, just make sure you subscribe and rate and review the podcast, because when it comes every day, it'll be thick and fast, and hopefully we'll sail up the charts. Miguel, best of luck in Russia.
Thank you. Today's your day.
Shakira. Yeah. If I get good at editing podcasts, I'm going to start chucking music and stuff in.
Cool, yeah.
Hopefully there's no sort of rights issue.
Probably
but
will be.
We'll just wait for the legal letter and deal with it from there. Until then, I will see you in Moscow.
Yep.
Tomorrow.
I'll see you in Heathrow.
But I will also tomorrow, me and you will both be in Russia, and I will see you there.
Yeah.
And yeah, if you've got any suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the podcast from Russia, behind the scenes stuff, whatever, then please let us know. And also, I forgot to say the bloody Instagram, which is at the Independent Sport or some of that Independent Sport. And there'll be loads of Instagram stories like that, and stuff from behind the scenes. So thank you so much. Really appreciate you all listening. And we will see you on the other side.